Get your daily market recap on the latest stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update is an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcasts.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrow and Lisa Abramowitz. Join us each day for insight from the best in economics, geopolitics, finance, and investment. Subscribe to Bloomberg Surveillance On Demand on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere you get your podcasts. And always on Bloomberg.com, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business App. We mentioned yesterday, Adam Posen was with us. PhD from Harvard. He was lights out, I thought. And one of the reasons we had Dr. Posen on is Dr. Furman of Harvard, teacher of ECTEN, which is the definitive economics course there at Harvard. Mankey used to throw chalk at people on it. And the answer is that was on globalization. That was on all the dynamics that are out there. And we've got a guy to start us off strong in this hour. Lisa, why don't you bring in not Kenneth Rogoff, but Bradley Rogoff, who, you know, I can understand why people got the two of them confused in economics, but why don't you bring in Brad Rogoff on this bond mess he and Barclays wrought?
I had Feldstein as my ECTEN professor at Harvard, actually, so I'm dating back before
but
Mankey.
I wonder what Marty Feldstein would say of this crisis. He would say we have to clear the market, clear out the losers, wouldn't he?
I think that's probably about
right. We're not doing that right now, from what I can tell.
Well, but Brad, how do you make sense right now as the head of FIC research over at Barclays? How do you understand whether the market is just simply wrong to price in both rate hikes and some sort of disinflation that continues?
Yeah, I think we don't agree with that. I'll start with that. I think we expect, yes, could there be rate hikes coming when you get to 2020, rate cuts coming in 2024? Sure, right? But we think there's going to be one more hike this summer. And it is hard to marry, I think you guys were just alluding to it, where equities are, which don't seem to go down, and when you look at what the market's pricing in terms of eventual cuts later this year. Now, Lisa, you were kind of alluding to some of the stuff around banks, and look, this is a banking crisis, but the reason, you know, I think we're calling it that, I guess, at this point, but the reason we got there is very different than a lot of other banking crises. It wasn't because of bad assets, right? It was because of duration, really, more than anything. I do think there's a little bit of a distinction between that, and I guess if you had to choose your crises, I'd probably rather have this one.
But there's also a distinction between the idea of bank failures.
Yep.
And the idea of credit materially constrained and more suddenly than it has been in the past. How do you draw that distinction in terms of how to price that into a market that's looking for either 2008 or all clear?
See that is the difference, right? Is maybe right now we can say we're clear of the crisis that we went through, you know, especially the last couple of weeks. But it has consequences still, and those consequences don't have to be 2008. I think to your point. Those consequences can be slower growth. And whether we get to, you were alluding to some forecasts of a modest recession in the back half of this year or early next year, some people have that in, or just really low near zero growth, which is what we're kind of closer to. Mm-hmm. Those have a big impact and also probably aren't that consistent with where equities are today, right?
I had a guy just email in. He's watching the show on JetBlue Airlines. I think it's on DirecTV. Thank you for DirecTV and JetBlue for putting us on across the nation. But he's got a really important question. And that is, okay, we had low-rate free lunch for decades, and now we're back here. Is this rate regime behavior forward like what you and I studied, or is it something new, this new higher rate regime?
Well, I think that, yeah, if we don't have to go back that far to have a rate regime like this, right? We can go back 15 years, a little more than 15 years ago and have that. The difference, I think, is that prior to that, we didn't have the really low rate regime. So I don't think it's just the fact that we have this, I mean, some might argue more normal as opposed to high rate regime right now. I think what it is you had that period of such low rates. So then it leads to so many assets in fixed income specifically pricing at a substantial discount. And that leads to the disconnect that led to the problems that we saw in banks. So I do think it's a low rate regime that's causing the problem as opposed to the current rate regime.
The whole financial system, and I'm going to go back to Chris Whalen's glorious one volume on the American financial system and crisis as well. So I got a guy on JetBlue or whatever airline they're on watching this show. And what it signals here, Bradley, is the fear that's out there. Should we fear this new rate regime?
As I said, I don't know that we need to fear the current rate regime. Also, because by having hiked the way the Fed has, they do have some room now to actually, through non-extraordinary policy, have an impact if we get to a place where inflation's come down a bit, let's say, you know, later this year, early next year, and growth has come down. So I think in that sense, you'd almost have, you know, more fear if this was happening and rates were at zero today, right? I think that could be quite problematic.
I strongly agree. Lisa, to me, this is the heart of the matter. And there's so many younger people who didn't study Martin Feldstein a million years ago, where can we celebrate that this is maybe normal with proper incentives of capital versus Mr. Rogoff's comment there on zero?
Well, I would argue that it's really too soon to tell. And I think that to your point, Brad, and this to me is really the key point, it's one thing to have a normal rate of interest. It's another thing to do it after years and years of 0% rates that inflated assets and caused leverage to build up at a rate that might be infeasible for companies based on their business model. So how do you discern what seems like something that gives you income versus something that will crimp companies, cause higher defaults, and create someone to charge a much higher risk premium?
It's very interesting because what do we all expect? And I'm sure you had a lot of people on this show say it. Well, how are these Fed hikes going to impact the economy? Where are we going to see the problems? Well, the answer was going to be, oh, maybe it's going to be the consumer, for example, right? It's going to be higher levered assets and credit, right? The world that I spend a lot of my time in. It turns out it was the safest assets that led to the first part of it, right? And I think that's what you're getting to, Lisa. There will eventually be some impact, right, on those riskier assets, things, you know, lower rated, high yield bonds, and all of those things. But just like 2020 is helpful in the sense of, and I know it's hard to say this looking backwards, but there are companies that were higher levered, that were problematic, they defaulted then, and not as much excess built in the system. So I think just like that, having this little bit of a preview, I do think that even though we will see defaults come up and all of that stuff, I don't think it'll be as extreme.
So this, to me, is one of the big questions, especially with the banking issues that we've seen. Is this perhaps froth that we've already seen pushed out of the system, or is there another shoe to drop? Where would you look for that other shoe to drop?
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's a question of just, you know, from how far up you're dropping that shoe, right? Like, so there will be eventual impact in terms of, okay, if banks are lending less, that has to have an impact on corporate America. I do think we come into this fundamentally in a pretty good spot, right? And so we don't expect the normal, you know, recession default rates are 10, 12% that you've seen, right? We expect it probably be more like half that. However, there's other areas, right? You know, if you think about the increase in rates, commercial real estate is the one that's coming up quite frequently right now.
And we should extend the interview.
Yeah, that's why I came into the studio. And that's one where obviously with cap rates have to move when rates move. And so I think there are a lot of other areas, and that has an impact too, because people hold that on balance sheet.
We've got 30 seconds left, which is a perfect time to dive into this. Commercial real estate, challenged, right?
Yeah, I think it is. You know, we're pretty focused on office as being the area we're most concerned about. And, you know, we think the peak to trough there could be up to 30%.
Brad Rogoff, thank you so much. Bradley Rogoff is with Barclays. One of the things we missed here is a data check on Europe. It was quite a 10 days for Europe, and we're thrilled to bring you this morning. Katrina Dudley, portfolio manager at Franklin Mutual Series, doesn't describe her true European portfolio expertise. Are you optimistic about Europe, Ms. Dudley?
I think that if we look at what happened last week, you know, Europe actually was kind of contained until the end of last week from the banking crisis, which was really started in the United States. And I think that that was a positive. But towards the end of last week, we saw what was happening in the U.S. kind of move into the European markets, and we saw some downward pressure in those European banking stocks. As I look at Europe, I think, however, that the structural drivers that we've been talking about for now a couple of months continue to underpin that market. So we can just continue to be optimistic.
Well, when we're optimistic, we have to mop up a Swiss banking regime. I thought over the weekend, particularly the FT had some nice articles showing the Swiss people rebelling against a Swiss bank bailout of Credit Suisse as well. Does that carry over in the financial section in Europe to where there's a huge tension between people, governments, and the banking industry?
I think there's been a lot of tension in the European banking industry already. I think that we need to understand that the way that the Eurozone is constructed is it's a series of countries, and each of those countries has a central bank that will support that in-country banking system. We saw that with Deutsche Bank. We've seen that support come out for Germany, for example. We've seen it, as you described, with Credit Suisse and with UBS and the Swiss National Bank stepping in as well. So you will see that on a country basis, and it's a real reflection of the fact that Europe is just a series of countries that have come together to create the Eurozone, that those nationalistic interests still exist.
There's a larger question here underpinning some of the banking stress. Are we at the end of rate hiking cycles that have been the fastest on record? Katrina, what's your view?
I think that the Fed is very data dependent, and they're also watching that PCE number that is coming out on Friday. I think that they'll be as glued to their Bloomberg screens as I am. They're going to be watching to see whether or not there is any easing in inflation pressures. If there is, I think that they can just take a pause in that rate hiking cycle. But I have heard a lot of people thinking that we are going to have rate cuts towards the end of this year. We're not in that camp that we're expecting the Fed to turn so quickly. We think that they're more likely to take a pause in terms of the rate hikes. And potentially, you know, there's been a lot of quantitative tightening in the market, and we're starting to see some of that ease.
Katrina, if that's the case, how do you play it through a market that has priced in almost 100 basis points of rate cuts by the beginning of next year?
In terms of how we play it, we just think you need to take a step back. And I think that that's the benefit of being a long-term investor, that ability to take a step back and have a look. I think that we were very concerned that the banking crisis and the increase in rates would really impact those small and mid-sized companies. And we've talked in the past about the industrial sector, and we talk about the three legs to that investment thesis. We look at the legislation that's positive, and that's still in place. We look at some of those structural drivers, electrification, for example, IoT is another. But the third leg was that supplier base that needed financing in order to expand. And we've actually seen customers step into the place of the certainty that you normally get from the financial sector. So we're actually continuing to be very, very positive on the industrial sector demand, because that third leg of the stool continues to be strong.
Katrina, I got 30 seconds left. I'm sorry for this. It deserves a much longer amount of time. Bernard Baruch once said, by straw hats in winter, I'm seeing images of Paris in revolt. I'm seeing talk about a collapse of the Fifth Republic, of Macron, maybe even a reformation of a new republic, a Sixth Republic. Can you go long France here, given all the turmoil?
I think that what you need to understand is what has happened in each of these markets. Look at their response to the energy crisis, because they stepped into the market to support that low-end consumer, and it's those consumers that are going to remember that, and that's where the popular pressure really comes, that populist pressure, which really looks at these markets fragmenting. I think that that argument has gone out the window. We think that Europe's stays together, and that is positive for all those markets in Europe.
Katrina, thank you for helping us start the show this morning. Katrina Dudley here with Franklin Mutual. Joining us now with Jenny Montgomery Scott is Christopher Marinac. He is in banking research, an important voice to speak to at this time. Let's just start with first principles in the moment, Christopher. Is the crisis over?
I think think we're getting to the end. The two troubled banks have been resolved, and I think now we see resolution from both Signature Bank last week and yesterday with First Citizens buying the Silicon Valley. So I think we have to get to the end of the quarter on Friday, but I feel like we are on the road to recovery, and I think when earnings are announced in a few weeks in mid-April, you're going to see much better results and much better deposit flows than most investors have understood the last few weeks.
I guess I've got to go to deposit flows right now. We're going to get more reporting on that. One of the themes out there is, well, at 5%, forgetting about bank crisis, money's going to move to money market funds. Do you agree?
Well, we've seen money market mutual funds move $250 billion the last 2 weeks if you look at the Thursday reporting. So clearly there has been some movement. But I think in the big picture, Tom, there's, I think, a lot less deposit outflow in the system. It's only 4.5% if you look at the Fed data last Friday night. So it's more muted. And I think we've been normalizing deposits all along. It just has felt a lot worse the past few weeks.
You know, I'm going to use the Jenny Montgomery Scott history here of Philadelphia, and you go out to traditional banking outside Philadelphia, and that's a place where it would be like anywhere in America. What I detect here is banking by marketing concept. When you talk to bankers who are like normal people, how do they feel about marketing concept-driven ideas intruding in this crisis on their normal banking?
Well, to most customers, they're looking for service. They're looking for more than just interest rate. If interest rate was the only thing, then I think we would have seen the bank deposit costs rise a lot faster the previous four or five quarters. It's been a very slow increase of deposit rates. I think we are going to see a meaningful impact in higher rates in Q1 and Q2. But in my opinion, it's a much more muted response. Customers want safety and surety, and they also want advice. So it's not always about interest rate.
That's the dog barking in the background, just in case you knew that. His name is Chipper.
I was
after
wondering.
Chipper Jones.
I was wondering, you know, if Chipper was having
Chipper,
serious concerns
Chipper's
about
barking
the,
this morning.
He's having angst about the banking system. I am wondering.
The Braves have beat the Red Sox like four times in spring training, just so you know.
Thank you, Tom. Christopher, I am curious. There's this article by Mohammed Alarian on Bloomberg Opinion. I keep going back to it because it really highlights this one aspect that people are honing in on. Even if we don't get some collapse in financial system or another bank, there still is going to be a grinding tightening, a sort of acceleration in how much some of these regional banks withdraw some of their credit. How much are you tracking that? How much do you believe that narrative?
Well, I think that credit always gets tightened in a crisis like this. We saw it in 2008 and 2009. I think banks are going to be very discerning on the new loans they make. There's a lot of pipeline lending that was done in January and February, and I'm sure it became a lot tighter the last 3 weeks. So as we head into second and third quarter, I think new loans will be very much lower. And if anything, you're going to see much higher rates. I think one of the mysteries is that bank loan rates are going to be a lot higher. Banks are going to charge more for risk. And that actually is going to be a benefit, and it will offset some of the higher deposit rates that we see. But I think your question's a good one, and ultimately, credit is getting tighter.
So in other words, just to sort of frame this a little more starkly, could we see banks survive and even thrive, especially if they're consolidating business, at the same time that you see a more dramatic constriction in overall growth in the U.S.?
Well, I think dramatic might be the thing I would disagree with. I think it's going to be incrementally slower. Banks are still in the business of taking risk and making a discerning vote of confidence for their customers. I think leverage overall is so much lower today than it was 15 years ago. We see a lot of banks lending at 65 to 70 cents on the dollar when they used to lend on 90 to 100, and then the properties were coming down in value significantly. So we have less leverage in the system, and I think ultimately that's a key to what banks write off and their problems. So I think credit does get tighter for sure, but I don't think it's impossible. And I think, if anything, banks are here for businesses that they wish to support. The key is the companies, I think, who are in good financial position can continue to move forward, and those who cannot will struggle. So, you know, we do expect to see higher levels of credit issues as this year and next year unfold.
One of the big questions in the past couple of weeks is how much of a risk premium will be charged for some of the smaller and regional banks that could suffer deposit outflows in a way that the large banks just can't. How much is that going to be a lasting feature, that basically the valuation story is going to be more disparate going forward of the behemoths versus the regionals?
I think the regionals and even the smaller community banks are going to do quite well. We think the deposit outflow theme has been incorrect. And I think as the data is shown for March 31st, you'll see a lot less outflows than folks have understood. I also think you're going to see a lot more clarity about the level of granularity of deposits at these smaller and mid-sized banks. So I actually think it's an opportunity for them to really open the kimono, give a lot more disclosure on deposits, the lack of deposit concentration. That's going to be a huge difference when we see earnings come out in a few weeks.
Chris, the Wall Street Journal editorial lays out the first, whatever it is, the bank that went up 45% yesterday. They're taking out First Citizens. They're taking out SVB. How do the banks you follow, Chris Marinac, compete with a bank that has a massive support, gains, losses, deposit coverage, et cetera, deposit flight? How do other banks compete with someone so aided by the government of the United States of America?
Well, the reality is a lot of it comes down to individual relationships with bankers. And so you can have a lot of government aid for a given bank and a support at a moment in time, but it really doesn't have anything to do with the individual relationships and the advice that's given at banks. I think a lot of commercial businesses see a bank as a trusted advisor in addition to their attorney, in addition to their accountant. So I don't think that the government aid has much to do with that. I think, if anything, it's going to be an ongoing conversation about what those customers need and ultimately what they need to grow their business. I think businesses are slowing down as a result of this crisis this month, and that goes back to the credit tightening that is out there. I think there's a decision by many businesses to not increase their factories and increase their workers incrementally, just given what they've seen.
Hugely valuable. Christopher Marinac, thank you so much. Jenny Montgomery Scott there this morning. Joining us now, Victoria Fernandez, whose major charm is she's not on the island of Manhattan. She is out there and across the rest of America. Also on with us because I have a final zero, and she's actually, I think she had one or two of the final four picked out, so she's our resident genius for March. Victoria Fernandez, I'm going to cut to the chase. There is a banking crisis, and it plays differently among the financial centers than it does across Texas and the rest of this country. Tell us how the financial crisis, the banking crisis, rather, that we're in now, adjusts the strategies of Crossmark Global Investments.
Yeah, well, first of all, I'm going to say, unfortunately, my Cougars are no longer in the final
there
four,
it was.
But that's okay. We'll go from there. When we look at what's going on in the banking sector, we have to say, wait, all of this has tightened financial conditions. That's the key point that we're looking at right here. So when you have tighter financial conditions, which the Fed has been trying to do for such a long period of time and has not been very successful at it, the banking crisis did it pretty quickly. People are saying, depending on what analyst you talk to, it could be anywhere from 25 to 100 basis points of rate hikes that they have seen because of the crisis that's kind of now built in. Here's what we have to watch with that. When you have tighter financial conditions, you guys were talking about the smaller banks that are out there. Let's look at the senior loan officer survey that comes out in a couple of weeks and see what is happening with lending. It's probably coming down. That's going to affect M2 growth. It's going to affect economic activity. That flows through to earnings because pricing power is gone. Margins are going to get hit. And that then flows through to the labor market. This is the progress that the Fed is watching. They want to see this happen. And
right.
So I think this is, fits into their story. But Tom, here's the thing. That can change pretty quickly if the data changes.
So how do you change equity allocation? I mean, the charm of Crossmark is you're working with real people, with real money. Everybody, including me, is real scared about some of the banking news that we see. Given some level of new restriction or super restriction, how do you change your equity allocation?
Yeah, well, John's not there today, so I guess we can talk about the Dow a little bit.
There are. Continue.
We've seen the Dow down year to date, but we've seen the NASDAQ and the S&P higher because of the big turnover, people going into those tech stocks. What we're actually doing at Crossmark is trimming some of those tech stocks because they've had this run and we don't anticipate we're going to continue to see it because we don't think rates are going to continue to fall right here. We think we're going to see them turn around. We continue to look at quality names, names with strong balance sheets, names with good business models. That's what we're focusing on. We have some cyclical, we have a little bit of growth in there too, but some of those value names. It's when we hit the recession, which previously we would have said that was later in the year. Now we're looking more summertime. That's when you're going to start to go a little bit growthier. That's when you're going to start to look at maybe the lower quality names that tend to do better once right. we hit a sustained recovery.
What are the quote unquote lower quality names in the Dow Jones Industrial Average?
Well, I think you just have to look at some of the names, some of these that have been really hard hit. We're looking at names that do the opposite of what we were just talking about, that typically don't have the strongest balance sheets. Their earnings are not the strongest there. I'm not going to give specific names on those because we're not buying them right now. So compliance would be a little have an issue.
Yeah,
with
but nobody's
here.
Watching. But, continue.
Yeah, exactly. So you can't do that. I will say names that we have been adding a little bit to. JP Morgan, because of what's happened there and their valuations look strong. Some of the more stable names that we have in there and healthcare names. We'll come out of those and go into some of the other names, you know, looking at the more cyclical growth names once we hit a recession, looking at middle of the year.
Victoria, if the Fed cuts rates, do you get more bullish on risk assets?
You know, it's an interesting question because it depends why we're seeing rates being cut. If we're seeing rates cut because we anticipate a recession, we're going to wait a little bit longer. If we're actually in a recession and we're cutting rates and it's the start of a new sustained bull market, then yes, then I think you can do some risk assets. You don't want to go into those names until we get to the recession. You don't get your bottom in your market before that. So we need to wait and see that. We're not particularly saying 100%. We've already seen the bottom in the market. So we're still being cautious, biding our time a little bit. I'd rather be a little late to the party than get there early and not have anything there.
Just quickly, Victoria, what's the best hedge right now against a potentially higher inflation environment for longer?
Well, look, you're asking a bond girl this question. And so I'm going to tell you, you need to have that diversification in your portfolio by adding some fixed income. And don't just add short-term fixed income because you're setting yourself up for interest or for reinvestment risk once those bonds mature. Mm-hmm. Do a barbell strategy, add some fixed income, and then the equity, right. Add some of those claims.
Bond girl, 30 seconds here. United Healthcare with that ginormous bond deal. It takes them out to 11%, 12% debt, which many people in the textbooks would say still underdebted. United Healthcare in the last 10 years is up 25.6% per year. That's their stock. Are we going to see a ton of issuances by the quality names of the Dow Jones Industrial Average?
I wouldn't be surprised if we did, Tom, especially if people anticipate that rates are going to go a little bit higher. If they believe the central banks that there's more work to do, then we could see some issuance come in and lock in some of the lower rates that they have right now.
Victoria, thank you so much. Victoria Fernandez there, Crossmark Global Investments. To give us a perspective now, our definitive expert on China, Stephen Engel, in his very late evening in Hong Kong. Stephen Engel, I want to go beyond the headlines here, just to your perspective on the government, on Mr. Xi, and on Jack Ma. Is Jack Ma still part of a new six-unit Alibaba?
Yes and no. He is the face, obviously, is the founder, co-founder of Alibaba. And I love this story that you just talked about meeting Jack Ma. I've met him many times over my 20 years at Bloomberg and 32 years now in Asia Pacific. And he always talked kind of not nonchalantly, but a bit of a chest puffed out about regulation and that how he had to stay ahead of the regulators. Well, obviously, the regulators caught up with him in October or thereabouts of 2020, scuppering that big, multi-universe IPO for Ant Financial. And since then, the company has been absolutely obliterated, going from, I'm not talking about Ant. Ant's been sidelined, absolutely. But Alibaba's gone from an $800 billion valuated company down to about $220 billion. So now they're going to not break up, but they're going to kind of be reshuffled. Is this at government order? We don't know. Is it going to unlock more value than the pre-breakup, if you will, or pre-Ant breakup? We don't know yet. A lot of questions to be answered.
There is, though, one clear underlining feature here, which is government intervention in businesses that used to be the darlings of the nation. This person who used to be Steve Jobs, but even much more so in terms of the reception that he would get on stage and in these sort of rock star events that he would hold. Stephen, what does this say in terms of the climate right now and how quickly it is changing in modern China?
Well, the government's trying to say all the right things. Keep in mind, they're having the China Development Forum. In fact, in Beijing right now at the Diaoyutai State Guesthouse, just wrapped up today. Tim Cook is there, Ray Dalio, and a few others. But a number of big name U.S. CEOs kind of stayed away, not necessarily wanting the blowback in the United States because of the relationship troubles between China and the United States. But then they're going to have their World Economic-like Forum called the Boao Forum that started today as well down in Hainan Island. They're trying to make the sales pitch back to skeptical global investors after three punishing years of COVID zero, as well these regulatory, simultaneous regulatory crackdowns on the platform economy, on the private sector, on property, on online gaming, on so many sectors of the economy all at once. They're talking up the private sector. The government wants to support the private sector. But again, we've kind of rolled our eyes a little bit because we get tired of the narrative for three straight years of saying they want to do this and then acting differently. I'm gonna throw a little bit of caution on this. The market likes this right now. They think this is an opportunity to reinvigorate and get that entrepreneurial spirit back into a behemoth, which was a behemoth, Alibaba, but it's been dwindled down by regulation as well as largesse.
Stephen, what is the public reception to the intervention of the Communist Party of China in some of these previously much heralded companies that represented the mainland?
I think there's a lot of frustration. That's anecdotal. I mean, I do talk to my sources in mainland China. There is a bit of frustration. Few people will go on record to say there's frustration, but there's been a power grab, if you will, at the top of echelon of leadership there, with Xi Jinping almost becoming absolute ruler with his loyalists as his deputies. So there's some speculation or some skepticism, if you will, that the good old days, perhaps for the private sector, are past them. But again, we just don't know, Tom.
Stephen, what's so important here, and to use your years and years of expertise, behind those red doors in Beijing, they're obviously recalibrating after the political moment of November, after the coronation, if you will, of moving Mr. Xi forward. And then the reality is we're hearing reports from Bloomberg News and others that the Belt and Road Initiative, to be polite, is struggling. How successful right now is their business, is their finance, is the Chinese capitalistic experience?
It's struggling, obviously, coming out of 3 years of COVID zero that really decimated confidence. It decimated investment coming into China. It perhaps also harmed in a more, tangible way, the confidence that others have in China. So the Belt and Road Initiative has turned into what some would say is debt diplomacy in some countries that are having some debt issues, obviously. So the jury's still out on the Belt and Road, for sure.
Stephen, one final question, if I may, with great respect for your years of service in Hong Kong. Is Hong Kong, the new Hong Kong, is it open for business?
It seems like it's open for business, and they're sure doing everything that they can. And we'll have to see as well whether the IPO market is going to rekindle confidence in Hong Kong as well. And that's one interesting thing. I'll come full circle on the Alibaba story. Those six individual units, Daniel Zhang, the CEO, says each one of those six individual units will be able to do their own fundraising. And if that means IPO, that means IPO. It's going to be up to the heads of those individual divisions. That could, because no restructuring like this would come without the blessing of the central government in Beijing. So this could mean that IPOs could be coming back to Hong Kong.
Our Stephen Engel from Hong Kong. Subscribe to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live every weekday starting at 7 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can watch us live on Bloomberg Television and always on the Bloomberg Terminal. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Keen, and this is Bloomberg.
Do you love Elon Musk? Do you hate Elon Musk? Do you have no idea what to think about Elon Musk? Then we have just the show for you.
He's become even more larger than life.
Buying Twitter doesn't get us closer to Mars.
They are like really close to the edge of like everything falling apart.
Like, oh, Elon, I volunteer, put a chip in my brain.
Each week on this podcast, we'll break down, analyze, and debate the most important stories on Musk and his empire.
It's all one big universe. You just work for Elon Inc.
From Bloomberg Businessweek, this is Elon Inc. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.